This is part two of our look at live streaming. As with part one, these podcasts are designed to help with any planning for next season and beyond. As you'll hear throughout, we don't know what the outcome will be. We recommend clubs await direction from the leagues before making any decisions if live streaming is something you want to pursue. Enjoy part two. We're now joined by Jack McGill from QTV. Jack, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
So, bit of a disclaimer to start. Me and Jack work on a few things. Jack's company, QTV, our broadcast or our production arm for our live streaming. So, I've been working with Jack for a couple of years, but thought he would be good to get on from a live streaming point of view and video point of view and discuss a few things. But Jack, before we get into some of that, just want to give us a little bit about your background and the life and what QTV do.
Yeah, sure. So from a personal point of view, I started at the BBC at Queen Margaret Drive in Glasgow and then laterally at Pacific Quay when the new building was built, and was at the BBC for about 9 years. And I never worked in sport at that time, really until the last year that I was there. And I had a rather odd role, a very niche role as the cricket correspondent for BBC Radio Scotland. Not a full-time role, as you might imagine. And during that time, I met a guy that was to become my business partner, Mike Stanger, and he was the co-commentator on Radio Scotland's ball-by-ball coverage of Scotland internationals, and I was the pitch-side reporter. And the producer that was putting together the coverage, he was also a cricket fan as well. And it started really with the three of us talking about actually playing cricket as a sort of staff activity. But then when BBC Scotland decided to axe its ball-by-ball coverage of Scotland internationals, we all felt a sort of sense of collective loss and decided that we would do something about it for ourselves. And that was where the genesis of QTV Sports came from. Mike and I got together with another BBC producer. Mike himself is also a former BBC producer. And we decided that we would start with a little bit of audio streaming, just audio commentary. And then we put video to that. And we generated, I think for all of us, what were really surprisingly large audiences with little or no marketing and the bare minimum of support at the time from Cricket Scotland. But then I think Cricket Scotland and then Cricket Ireland subsequently saw the value in what we were doing. After a very successful stream at the Grange in 2011, and that involved both Ireland and Scotland, and they said, "Look, we think there's a real future in live streaming." What they really meant by that was direct to consumer content, live content. We would be prepared to back this, but not backing enthusiastic amateurs. So that put the focus on us, and we decided we would form a company. And we did the very next day. We had a pint in the pub that night. We had a talk about it. We all put a little prediction on the table as to how much money we thought we would make in year one, which it was not very much. and then the next day we went, we spoke to a lawyer friend, and we incorporated ourselves, and QTV Sports was born. And that was 9 years ago now. That was July 2011. And we soon discovered that all the things that we thought were missing in coverage of Scottish cricket were actually missing in the coverage of other sports like hockey, netball, swimming, table tennis, badminton. And we went around all of the Scottish governing bodies and we spoke to them, and then eventually spoke to one of your former colleagues at the SFA. And the first thing we did for the Scottish Football Association was the Youth Cup final at St Mirren Park between Hearts and Rangers, and I think it got more than 100,000 uniques on YouTube and was an absolutely unqualified success, up to the very critical point at the end where the penalty shootout, which had gone through, I think it was about 11 or 12 each by this point, was reaching its climax, and the stream went down. And I remember your colleague at the time, who shall remain nameless, coming running out of St. Vernon Park. And we were sat in the back of a 4x4 doing this off a laptop. And just, he was red in the face, going, "What happened? What happened?" And me replying, "I don't know. I don't know." And it was, there was a lesson for everybody, I think, in that experience, that it's not as easy as you think, and that if you're going to do it, you should do it properly. And that rather educated my approach to how we were going to develop QTV Sports from that point onwards, which I hope is reflected in the work we do today, which is now working for international federations, continuing to work for Scottish Football Association, for the SPFL, more in broadcast than in digital, and for Scottish Rugby too. So it's been quite a journey over the last 9 years, but with its fair share of ups and downs, but a very enjoyable one.
So what do QTV actually provide service with?
So we started very much as a digitally focused company. I'd watched the Beijing Olympics in 2008 with a great deal of interest, and 2012 in London really set a new standard for what was possible with the live streaming of sport. And I just saw this as one-way traffic. I just thought, this is there's no going back from this. And it was obvious that the sports that we worked with really didn't have the sort of production budgets required for full broadcast, nor really did they have the scale of events a lot of the time that would attract broadcasters. So finding a direct-to-consumer alternative seemed, like the obvious thing to do, and the technological barriers to entry and the financial barriers to entry were dropping to a point where people with a good amount of production and editorial experience could get involved in that. But over the period of, I think that served us very well over a period of about 5 years, where we were doing live streaming of sport and some corporate events as well, and then doing highlights production. And then the first real change for us came when we got into partnership with Grabio, who are a cloud-based editing platform, and they were offered a platform where you could cut, edit real-time clips and get them out onto social media channels within 30 seconds or a minute after a goal being scored, or a perfect 10 in gymnastics, or whatever sport it was you were covering. And this was a really, really fantastic tool to engage fans. And they also gave us the opportunity to stream on multiple platforms at the same time, which was unique at that point. And so we started to really diversify the range of digital content that we could offer, from not just the live, but using the live to underpin an amplification of content across a range of in a range of different ways. And then probably about 2 or 3 years ago, we probably realized that the margins are not great in a digital-only world. But we were also seeing that what rights holders were looking for was the flexibility in their content to be able to live stream to markets when they wanted to live stream, and then where they had television broadcast deals, be able to do full broadcast quality content. And that if we were going to be able to scale and succeed and grow, then we were going to have to be able to deliver both of those things. So we really built the production model for the company over the last 2 to 3 years on this kind of flexible mixed economy of being able to do traditional outside broadcasting with outside broadcast truck and, full fiber cables and cameras and switchers and audio desks, and do it with all of the bells and whistles, but then also have this lightweight model of live streaming that could go into non-broadcast environments and still be able to produce high quality content. And then finally, I suppose this year really has been, this year is a defining year for all of us for any number of reasons. I think we're about, we're in the process of finding out. But this year, our big strategic move is into remote production, and it appears that that could not be more timely with the likely physical distancing measures that it looks like we're all going to have to get used to for the next few months or maybe longer. And remote production is really about starting to think about how you reduce the number of people you have on site, both from a carbon footprint point of view. So you want to, our sector, I think, is under pressure to start demonstrating its green credentials. And this is one way of doing it, by sending fewer trucks out, fewer people out. And the second thing is obviously a financial thing. And the greater the distance between you, your production center, where you're producing everything centrally, and the venue, the greater the saving, both for the environment and for your purse and your budget. So this is going to be a really exciting opportunity for us. And we've already, you know, we've been doing a lot of remote light productions over the last 12 months with International Netball. We did an international table tennis event from Oman, which just had the three camera operators and an engineer on site in Oman, and then the director, the replay, the graphics, and the audio was all managed from back in Glasgow, and it was a big success. And we really see that now as the future for QTB Sports.
Obviously, we're in a kind of unprecedented time, Jack, as well. Like, is there anything else on top of the remote aspect of things that you do see as the future for live streaming?
I think live streaming is a very healthy future. I would stand by my prediction back in 2008 and 2009 that this was just going to be one direction of travel for the way we produce content. I think there's probably a couple of reasons why it's in a really healthy state. I think what coronavirus is going to do to the relationship between broadcasters and rights holders is going to be quite interesting, because there's going to be a lot of rights holders that are going to have to pay money back, both to sponsors and to broadcasters. And I think that means globally, and this isn't specific to Scotland, and it's not certainly not specific to any particular sport, but I do think that it's going to reduce budgets. And I think a lot of events that might have been looking at broadcast previously are probably now having to think about an online model. And where that impacts entire tiers of a rights holder's portfolio. So you might have, if you were a badminton or table tennis federation, you have a sort of gold tier, a silver tier, and a bronze tier of events. And your aspiration for those bronze events might have been as much broadcast as possible. And in a post-COVID-19 world, that just might not be possible for the foreseeable future. So you may be looking at how you can package those up as an online direct-to-consumer offering with a lower cost of production, more remote production probably, using IP rather than satellite, and all of these kind of new pieces of technology that are coming to the fore within the industry to create an OTT or streaming platform for those sorts of events. So I think we're going to see an upsurge in the number of direct to consumer kind of event productions and live streaming, but yeah, lower costs, yeah, lower budgets. Lower budget probably means a lower spec of production, and lower spec of production means that you're probably looking at something that's optimized for online rather than for TV.
Just in terms of maybe for me, who's someone who isn't really into it on the day-to-day as such, or hasn't really looked into any of these options, and that may be the same for some clubs out there, and what options are there for clubs when it comes to live streaming some of their matches?
Well, you're limited by Article 48. That's the first thing I would say with your Saturday 3 p.m. kickoffs. I think live streaming for football particularly, I think live streaming gives clubs a great opportunity to get other content out. So if it's the bigger clubs, that could be pre-season games. It could be European games, of course, where they have the rights to use them. But it could be representative age group matches. It could be youth games. Women's games as well. I think we're going to. I think there's a huge opportunity for women's clubs to use live streaming as a way to raise the profile of the game in Scotland, and to establish itself as a broadcast product. I've often looked at live streaming as a first step towards full broadcast content, but you've got to create a product that's going to attract the broadcasters to your sport or to your club or to the level of your sport. And I think there's a really good opportunity in live streaming for the women's game there. There are a number of different ways in which you can live stream. There's obviously a very cheap and easy way to do it, which is on YouTube. YouTube and Facebook and Twitter actually as well, or Twitch, all give you a free platform, free data, but they give you less control over what you can do with that content. So you're restricted in terms of what kind of advertising or sponsorship messages you can put through it, because of their community guidelines. And then once it's up there, your opportunities to present it in a brand consistent way are less, obviously. If you then take it onto a white label platform where you're paying a video host to host your data, host your content, and you're paying for that privilege, then obviously it gives you far greater choice and options over how that looks and how it's presented. But the one thing I would always say about, and this is maybe something we come on and talk to specifically, the one thing I would always say to clubs that are looking to live stream is that it can only be one part of what has to be a much broader communication strategy. You need to think about how you're presenting, not just a live stream, but then what you do with it afterwards. It gives you a huge amount of content to use and strip across a whole week in between matches, whether that's in the form of goal clips or longer form highlights, post-match or pre-match interviews, analysis from, you know, with maybe from within the fan base or from within or inside the club itself. The live is only one part of what has to be a bigger whole.
You see across Scottish football, obviously in the top division, a lot of the clubs now have their subscription model when it comes to live streaming. And as you said before, the blackout at 3 p.m. means they're limited to pretty much international subscriptions, anything from Red TV to Celtic TV, Rangers TV, St Mirren TV. You can see a theme here with the TV names. And then look, you go down to League One, and East Fife have got one as well. I know you've done some work with Partick Thistle before in terms of theirs. How easy is it from your experience working with these clubs and setting up these subscription and broadcasts?
I think it's relatively straightforward if the quality of what you're producing is of a reasonable standard. It's easy enough to find yourself a partner. You want to find a good technology partner in this, and there are a number out there. The partner that we used when we worked with Partick Thistle was StreamAMG. Now they're one of the biggest UK companies involved in this, and they don't do production. What they do is the hosting of your stream. They'll manage your paywall, and they'll help you skin and design the sort of microsite on which your content will sit as part of your overall website offering. And they're excellent, and they were great. They're an incredibly efficient company, and they know their onions. You know, they're very experienced at this, and it's very easy to go to a company like that. There are others out there that provide that service. Tell them what it is you're trying to achieve. But I mean, again, and as much as I say that, for the consumer, for the audience, the fans, the live stream is only one part of it. If you're going to a company like that and you're asking them to do something like a revenue share model, if you're East Fife, StreamAMG know that they're not going to make a huge amount of money out of that. So they'll want to know that you've thought it through. You have a plan. Here is the media plan. Here is how we're going to engage people. Here's how we're going to drive subscriptions. we've got good data on our fan base and we know who's likely to pay and what level they're likely to pay. So if you do all that homework in advance before you approach these companies, and you can give them a lot more confidence that what you're offering is authentic. And then I think the second thing about ease is what level of production you actually want to put in. So when we worked with Partick Thistle, there were two ways in which we worked. 1 year they were in the Premiership, and of course they had four cameras from the host broadcast company at the time. That was normally BBC Scotland, and I think very occasionally it was us actually at the time. And so being able to take a four camera mixed feed from a host broadcast company and using that for your OTT platform gives you a natural, there's an inbuilt quality and a baseline that you've established for the quality of your coverage. And that's not going to be the same the lower down you go, because there isn't a host broadcaster there every week, and you as the club are going to be responsible for putting in your own production. So you've got a decision to make as to how complex you want to make that. Obviously, with a single camera, it's a lot more straightforward. And really, the skill set that you need from that individual is that they're a good ball follower and understand the flow of a game of football and can anticipate what's going to happen in the pitch, because they've got to capture everything and they've got to be able to do it very smoothly and not in a way that is going to jar with the fan watching at home. When you start adding in other cameras, then you're looking for different skill sets. You're looking for somebody that knows how to direct and to cut. And you're probably looking at that point at whether you can put in replays, a basic replay system, or whether you can put in graphics as well. And so it very quickly grows arms and legs. And you need more people, and you need the same people, and you need to build up skills. Even if it's just on a voluntary basis, you need to build up those skills within the club. The ease with which you can do it is really depends on how ambitious you want to be with it.
And hypothetically speaking, if a club decides, and for whatever reason and whatever the state football is in when it comes back initially, that they want to bring in somebody like yourselves to help do this, what sort of business models do you guys work with clubs?
Well, if it's to set up an OTT platform with a video host and a paywall, then we would defer to a company like StreamAMG. And in our experience, the business model you're going to get that doesn't require any upfront cost from you, the club, is a 50-50 revenue split on whatever you can generate through the paywall. And that's fairly standard, not just in football, in other sports that we've worked with paywall providers in the past. Generally speaking, there might be some kind of admin fee on that. There's like maybe 10% or between 5% and 10% admin fee on that if there's a third party involved in processing the payments themselves. But if it's just one provider you're dealing with, generally speaking, it's 50-50 paywall. If it's us, we work on a commission basis. So somebody commissions us to do a piece of work. They ask us to quote on the basis of a certain level of production. So if it's two or three or four or five cameras, or just a single camera, if it includes graphics, doesn't, or replays, or doesn't, you basically choose the elements that you want to put into your stream. And there is a rate card that we have internally that we use to price that. And we would charge that fee. We have in the past done stuff on the basis of a percentage of the subscription, but we haven't done that in a long time, because the uncertainty that it creates for us, it probably doesn't suit the kind of staffing levels and overheads that we now have. But back when we were probably a bit smaller with fewer employees and more freelancers, that was easier to do. But fortunately, because I love my team, they're great. Fortunately and unfortunately, we now have a lot of mouths to feed, so it's less likely that we would undertake that sort of uncertainty. What we are always here though for is free advice, and I'm happy always to give out unconditionally give advice to any smaller rights holder that wants to do something to uplift the quality of their content. And sometimes if that derives some business benefit for us, then great. But a lot of the time it doesn't. And I'm quite happy with that, to be honest. I think in the current climate, with COVID-19 restrictions, that we don't yet understand and can't possibly predict, particularly I would say how long they're going to last. My advice to all the clubs would be to wait for the SPFL to give them a steer. Wait for the league, because there's too much uncertainty at the moment for clubs to be going out coming up with their own plan. So the advice would be wait until there's much more certainty, and then see where that takes coverage for next season.
Jack, can you just quickly take us through some of the common misconceptions maybe about live streaming that clubs maybe don't want to fall into if they do look to pick it up in future?
I suppose the first thing, and I could be accused of saying, well, he would say that because it's his business, but it's not as easy as people make it out to be. It is absolutely a relatively technologically straightforward thing to do. At a basic level, if certain preconditions can be met. So the first is connectivity is everything. If you don't have either a very good broadband connection or good 4G coverage, then it's a recipe for disaster. So that would be the first thing. That's not really a misconception, but I'm just saying it's people think it's easy to do. Well, that's the first precondition to making sure that it's easy to do. I think beyond that, there's it again just depends on the ambition of what it is you're trying to do. I think there's a misconception that people will accept anything in live streaming. And I think that used to be the case. I think when we were used to buffering and we were used to grainy pictures and maybe some dodgy sound, somebody filming on Periscope on their phone, that there is novelty in all of that if it's for a very short period of time, but it's not a standard that can be sustained, say, over the course of a whole match or over the course of a season. I think consumers, viewers, fans are now much more nuanced in their tastes and are probably less tolerant of poor quality than they used to be. And I think to build on that point, I would say that there is a common misconception that the picture is everything. And actually, it's not. It's generally speaking the audio that's everything, because there is a lot that you can get away with if people can still understand what is happening. And the way people watch live streaming often could be at a work computer, or it could be with a screen minimized. In a way that just allows them, when something exciting is happening or the commentator's excitement builds and they know that there's something coming, then they will then take a look at the picture. But if you don't have the audio, then it can be, then that's impossible. And I would say also that people should not underestimate the value of a good commentator as well. I think there's a misconception that anybody can just jump on a microphone or in front of a camera and that it will be, you know, that it's easy to do. It is a great skill, actually, in being able to commentate well and articulately, and not to become flustered. And I think if I was going, you know, if I was a club and I was going into this from the start, I would want to think about all of those things, and making sure that I'd met certain preconditions before I launched into a project. Doesn't take a lot of time to get your ducks in a row, but the preconception that you can just do it, it holds true up to the point that it will happen. But if you want to sustain something that's consistent and of good quality and that continues to engage and entertain people, then it's not as easy as it looks.
Jack, you've worked on the likes of NFL pre-match shows, you've done draws, Scottish Cup draws for us in the past. What have you seen work well and things that you'd like to see Scottish clubs or football clubs do more of?
I think one of the things that rights holders have that broadcasters do not is access. And one of the things that fans value more than most things is that access, is peering behind the curtain, and being able to get insight into the lives of players, administrators, coaches, in a way that just linear coverage of a sport doesn't allow. And clubs are the arbiters of that. They are the ones that have the players' contracts. They are the ones that can ask the players to do things that broadcasters can't. And I suppose the key to being really good, being really good at your job, Michael, and you know, or the equivalent of it in a club, is, I suppose, being able to build that relationship with the coach and have the trust of the coach and the players, A, that you're not going to make them look ridiculous, B, that there is a purpose to what you're asking them to do, and C, having the imagination to, and the, I suppose, the drive to look at good practice examples from all over the world, and not just in football, and in every sport, you know, go out there and actually seek out good types of content, and mimic it, or come up with your own. And I suppose, you know, the really good content that I see and that I enjoy is based around that access, is finding out stories about the people that you watch playing football week in, week out, that nobody else gets to see. And that look behind the curtain, I think, is and that type of storytelling, I think is really key to good content. The NFL show you talked to, the pre-match show that we did for NFL UK was really, I mean, it was rough and ready, but it was great fun because it was so unguarded and to a large extent unscripted. So it was a 30 to 40 minutes. It was a rather fluid concept, if I'm being completely honest. But we were pitch side, so it was, or sideline as it is in American football. But we were pitch side at Wembley in the VIP area, and the difference in a match day experience at the NFL to an association football match day experience is just, it's like chalk and cheese. I mean, it's completely different. There must be 100 VIPs, and that could be celebrities, it could be media, it could be competition winners, milling around for this half hour to hour before the game, watching the players warming up at really close quarters, being able to interact with them in some circumstances, And we had a roll-in, roll-out roster of celebrity guests, pundits, analysts, singers, coming in and just talking about the experience of being there, why they loved American football. And it was just, it was unguarded. And so people just behaved in a way that it wasn't a press junket interview, you know, it wasn't a sit-down press conference. It was just people having unguarded fun at a sport that they loved. And I don't see enough of that in football in the UK. It's also managed, you know, it's the press team have their job on the day, and the coach is probably quite defensive about allowing players to be distracted pre-match. And I get that there are limits to what you can do. The rights as well around what you can do pitch side. I mean, if you're if you're the Scottish Football Association, you've got a national team game at Hampden. You know, to what extent can you access that pitch side area? What can you do with your players? What can you do that's unique that allows you to use that access to deliver something that nobody else can deliver? And if you're restricted in your rights by UEFA or by FIFA, depending on who the rights owner is, then I think that's a great shame, because I think that media landscape in terms of what is now expected by and enjoyed by fans has totally changed. And I think I'd love to see more of that unguardedness about football that I think has been slightly lost from the modern game. Because those are the bits that are always most enjoyable when you see them online. And I think we're seeing a bit of that at the moment. You know, if you look at the way digital teams for maybe some of the Premier League teams down south, and Liverpool have been, I'm a Liverpool fan, so I follow what they do on Instagram and I follow what they do on other platforms, you know, and the insight into their daily yoga and the way they talk to each other and interact with each other is just seeing them in a just totally different light. And I'm not going to watch it for hours on end, but if it's a little piece of content that I kind of scroll through over my morning coffee and it makes me smile, then, you know, great, like, get on with my day, got work to do. But that sort of stuff I think is really successful. I wouldn't want to think that when we get past all of the COVID-19 stuff that we've, you know, kind of forget that stuff was actually quite entertaining, and we still let the players indulge in it from time to time.
I was just about to say that too. Yeah, I definitely spotted a few examples of clubs and players kind of showcasing that personality almost, and giving it a bit of that rawness that you maybe mentioned, the not as polished side of things. That I think Celtic's been an example of that in terms of letting some of the players take over their Instagram stories, asking questions, answering them, showing a kind of day in the life of them as well. I think that kind of thing is so interesting for fans, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. I think it is. But I mean, Michael empathised with recognise this, but there is a fear that is built into managing players' media activities, because social media can be unforgiving, you know, of the least, you know, of the smallest mistakes. But I sense at the moment that everybody's probably prepared to be a little bit more forgiving than they would in normal circumstances. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there, to be honest. Jack, that was absolutely fascinating. Have you got anything else that you would like to add just before we wrap up there?
I suppose that going back to advice for clubs, I wonder if I maybe articulated myself properly. The key thing that I would say about live streaming is it's not just about live streaming. It's about the whole story. So, you know, I think the best examples of social media campaigns or just generally digital content campaigns are the ones that tell a story from start to finish and are founded on some kind of key pillars, if you like. One being consistency. It's really important to be consistent as a club. People come to depend on a particular piece of content at a particular time of the week. So if you're doing match day highlights, they should go out at the same time every week. If you're doing the pre-match interview with the manager or the captain, it should go out, you know, T-minus however many hours before the game, and stick to it. You know, be strict with yourself about how you schedule content throughout the week, and know what your content plan looks like from week to week. And doing live coverage gives you this great anchor that can underpin your storytelling throughout the rest of the week, because you always have that to fall back on and to chop it up into smaller pieces. But it's too often, and this isn't strictly true of football, but it is true of a lot of smaller sports that I see embracing live streaming and content, is that a lot of the time it comes as an afterthought, and the quality is detrimented because it's not thought of as an kind of integral part of strategy, whether it's an overall marketing strategy or media strategy or just specifically just about live content. So I would encourage people to think, you know, use this time off to think about what their strategy is going to look like next season, to think about how they can activate the greatest range of content, probably with the fewest possible resources. But think about doing, you know, think about how to do that in the most efficient way possible. And if you do that with enough notice and you have the media package, even as a small club, if you're taking that out to sponsors, you can divide up sponsors for different types of content. And we know that because we have Player of the Match awards, and the Player of the Match award is quite often sponsored by a particular company, or individual match days are often sponsored by a local sponsor. But your content can be the same, so your highlights could be sponsored by one company, and your goal of the month compilation could be sponsored by another, and your post-match interview could be sponsored by another. And there are ways of building up assets that I think can help you as a club pay for having a little bit more ambition around, you know, around the content that you produce. It's never as straightforward as that, but it's worth taking this time while we're in lockdown, we're in isolation, to go out and look at best examples and start thinking, well, what can I do next year that's going to add to the content? And as I said earlier, you know, wait for a steer over what the league is going to look like next year, because there's a lot of I suspect there's a lot of road still to travel until we've got certainty over physical distancing and league starting and all that kind of stuff. So take all of this as a very hypothetical kind of scenario, but those things I think would be really, really important for people to think about.
No, definitely agree there, and I think it's, like you say, it's probably one of the best times you'll ever get if you're working at a club or an organisation to do this, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, we always complain that we never have enough time. Well, there's plenty of it about now, so use it wisely.
Jack, tell us where people can find you and QTV as well.
Yeah, in my house.
Good, stay safe, stay home.
Not on the golf course, he says with no hint of bitterness. You can find QTV Sports at online at www.qtvsports.com. You can find me personally on LinkedIn, but I'm more than happy to give out my business email address, which is simply jack@qtvsports.com.
Perfect. Michael, anything else to wrap up on before we head off?
No, Jack, that was great for us as well, and I think I would just encourage anybody that is listening to take up Jack's advice of free or offer of free advice, because there's a lot of good work that can be done, and as Jack says, live streaming is not suited to everybody, but if it's something that, depending on what happens, want to look and investigate further, reach out to Jack. I think is a good starting point.
Perfect. Yeah, definitely. Jack, again, thank you very much for coming on.
A pleasure. Thank you.